Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I'm pleased to introduce our guest this week, Dan Miller. Dan is the Executive Vice President of Gabelli Funds, Lead Portfolio Manager of the Gabelli Pet Parents Fund, the Gabelli Focus Growth and Income Fund, and a member of the investment team for the closed-end and separate accounts businesses. For those of you out in the audience, as always, do please feel free to post those questions and comments in that live chat section throughout the presentation, but keep in mind we generally like to hold those questions until we get to the end of things, just to make it nice and smooth for us. Without anything further from me, I'll go ahead and hand things over to Dan, and we can jump into things today.
Thank you, Graham. Nice to be here with all of you today, even though I can't see you. I trust that this is a pretty cool audience based on the questions that I've already heard from Graham, and I've heard from a few of you that have sent me the email introduction. Hopefully we can keep it somewhat brief in my remarks and then open it up for questions and answer whatever's on your mind today. I thought I'd start with maybe my background, talk a bit about our firm, and then get into the idea that the pet economy is a pretty interesting place to be invested at the moment. So I've been with Gabelli Funds and related groups for about 19 years now, if you can believe it. I'm home here in my office in Stamford, Connecticut, and I've lived here for about the same period of time. But I grew up in a small town in Florida called Lakeland, was very fortunate to attend college in Miami, where I met Mario Gabelli. My last month of school, when he was on campus speaking to the Board of Trustees about the portion of the school's endowment that he was managing. I was the student rep to the Board of Trustees at that time, and the president of our college said, "Mario, I want you to meet Dan Miller. He's one of our talented finance majors." We had a conversation, and long story short, I was hired. Packed up my car and moved to Rye, New York, where Gabelli has been based for the past 20 plus years. And I began in the operations department, kind of worked my way through various roles in sales and research, did some banking, began managing assets for clients about 10 years ago. Graham mentioned several of the funds that I've worked on. And really, it's been kind of an interesting journey learning Mario's investment process, philosophy, approach to just running a business also, which I'm happy to talk about. I've been privileged to not just work for Mario in various roles and be an investor, but also to help run businesses. I was nominated to the board of a public telephone company about 7 or 8 years ago, became chairman CEO of that business, built it, we sold it for about a 3x return, and I've been involved in some other projects that I'm happy to talk about as well. Maybe about the firm, Mario Gabelli started the first business, which was a sell-side brokerage, Gabelli & Company, in 1977. He was an analyst for about 10 years prior to that, covering auto parts and farm equipment. Very good analyst, as I'm sure you can appreciate. Started this firm as a one-man shop, marketing his investment ideas, different format than we use today, of course. And then began managing money, kind of one client at a time. There was a CEO of an auto parts company that he was covering and had known for a while, who said, "Mario, why am I trying to pay you commissions?" At that time, it was probably 25 cents a share. "When I can just give you a check, here's $1 million, earn me a return, and I'll pay you a fee." And so we got into that business managing separate accounts in 1977, 78. We have a terrific long-term record in what we call our all-cap value with a catalyst approach. And I'll talk a bit about private market value with a catalyst, which is kind of the predominant investment philosophy for most of our client portfolios and funds. He began managing a hedge fund in 1985 in a merger arbitrage strategy. Merger arbitrage, for those of you that don't know, is investing in announced deals. Zoom that still has phone calls that ring. Merger arbitrage is investing in announced deals or takeovers, typically in a cash deal. You just go long the target, you capture a spread over time, non-correlated to the equity markets, typically does well in a rising rate environment. In 1986, he launched the first mutual fund. That was the Gabelli Asset Fund, and that's still a $2 billion or so portfolio today. As a firm, we manage about $33 or $34 billion of assets, almost entirely in equities. We have $20 billion or so in open and closed-end funds, and another, obviously, $13 or so billion in separate accounts on behalf of endowments like Miami, but also high-net-worth individuals. Another. We have about 200 staff globally, but most of us based in or around Rye, but have offices in London, in Tokyo. We have research teams in Palm Beach and St. Louis, Chicago, Nevada. And of that 200 or so staff, there are probably 35 research analysts, which is really the backbone of how we generate returns. Each of them cover an industry. Most of them cover industries, and they do that globally. So, for example, we have someone that covers the broadcasters, someone that covers medical devices, and they do that globally, all cap, micro, small, mid, large, and mega, of course. Very talented team of traders that support the investment staff. There are probably 20 or so of us that manage portfolios in different formats and styles. I mentioned private market value with the catalyst being the kind of predominant investment philosophy or approach that we use. I would guess that it's 30 of the 33 billion or so is a kind of value with a catalyst. And what that means simply is the price that we think an informed investor, maybe a private equity investor, might pay to acquire a business in its entirety, multiple of EBITDA or cash flow, maybe revenues in a higher growing, faster growing industry, like we find today more often. That is the private market value of a business, the price someone would pay to acquire the entire business, as opposed to what a share is trading at today in the public markets. And then when we decide to, before we decide to make an investment, we think about the potential catalyst or event that might surface the discount between the current public market price and what we perceive or believe the private values to be. And so I'll give you some examples when I get into the PET fund and talk about where we're allocating capital there today. But it's a process that's really worked well for us in kind of, you know, different periods. Clearly, the last 10 years, value has not been the most inspiring place to be allocated, because you've had multiple expansion given a very low rate environment on technology and other growth related industries. I think that's changing, and we can talk about that if you have any questions. An important element to, I think, what we do and have done better than others is have a very intense focus on knowing the management teams that not just run a business, but also are involved in an industry. So we might be familiar with the CEO and CFO of a small cap gas utility company in upstate New York, who might inform how we view and think about the rest of the larger gas utility companies throughout the country. And so it's kind of Mario's really experienced and unique ability to ask the right questions, get the right information, of course, in a Reg FD world, but understand the moving pieces, how fundamentals are changing, how regulations are impacting the way a business might be positioned to grow over a 3 to 5 year period, how companies might be thinking about allocating capital or undertaking financial engineering. Are they interested perhaps in spinning off a business that isn't getting a multiple today in the public markets? And so as we've gotten to know management teams really well over a prolonged period of time, decades, we've been able to kind of invest alongside certain people that we think have been good stewards of capital for public shareholders. And that's really an interesting way to look at stock investing today, I think, when so many of us are overloaded with information from Twitter and blogs and great websites like this who are able to pass along information to us. In any case, I wanted to kind of use that as a transition to talk about someone named Bill Stiritz, who is someone that is in our Gabelli GAMCO Hall of Fame, someone that we have been invested with for probably 40 years. Bill ran a company called Ralston in the mid-80s. It was a conglomerate. They were obviously involved in human food, but also pet food. He engineered a series of spin-offs, share buybacks to surface value. One of those was the sale of the Ralston Purina pet food business to Nestle that occurred in 2001 for $10 billion. And it was really at that point in time that our team began to hone in on the very attractive characteristics of the pet economy, as we call it today. Pet economy, including not just pet food, but pharmaceuticals, supplies. Now you even have pet insurance, of course, and we can talk more about that too. But it's really been a growing industry, one that's consolidated, that I think has benefited shareholders because there's been some rich multiples. In fact, over the last 2 years, there have been about 100 deals that have taken place, 25 public companies in the last couple of years that have merged or been acquired in the pet economy with multiples that have ranged between 18 and 20 times EBITDA, 3 to 5 times revenues, very healthy multiples. And I think they're deserved because the category is growing and it's attractive and it's relatively mature. Some of the biggest deals, PetSmart and BC Partners combined in an $8.7 billion transaction. BCA Antech, the symbol for it was WOOF, W-O-O-F, symbol is now being used again by a different company, was purchased by Mars for about $9 billion. And of course, Blue Buffalo, well-known deal, Mills paid about $8 billion a couple years ago for that one. So we launched the Gabelli Pet Parents Fund April 1st of 2019. The symbol, if you want to follow along on our performance, is PETZX. It's an open-end mutual fund. It's long only, but it's global, actively managed, relatively concentrated. We're about 30 names, of which 10 or so are outside the U.S., where there's probably more of an opportunity, multiple expansion and earnings growth. Let me first maybe define the market. The U.S. market for pets is about 85 million households today. At least one pet in 85 million households. Pretty big number. 68% of families, in fact, have at least one pet. And that compares, by the way, to just 42 million families, so roughly half, that have a child under the age of 25. There are about 95 million cats in the U.S., 90 million dogs, 20 million birds, 140 million fish, and about 7.5 million horses. Horses are actually a pretty good market because of the amount of care that they require. The number of pets has been growing about 5% a year. We think that continues, particularly in the current environment where we all spend more time at home, less time on airplanes, less time traveling, less time on vacations, more time on social media and on our computers and iPads that have separated us from our friends and family, and pets have kind of filled that always important, more important than ever, interaction and companionship. So, in fact, 67% of pet owners say that their cat or dog is their best friend. There are some great stats out there about how much is spent on Valentine's Day on pets. It's a couple hundred million dollars. So, show you a picture if you can see it. This is my dog. That's Fanny, Cocker Spaniel. In any case, so let's talk about some numbers here. As we as humans think about taking care of ourselves, our health and our wellness, we're doing the same thing for our pets. So natural and organic pet food, curated, fresh, sent to our doors every week, like we do with human food. That's a very attractive and growing market. Since 2007, the U.S. pet industry has grown about three times that of GDP, and a big piece of that, about $80 billion, is in pet food. Globally, the pet economy is about $200 billion today. We think that reaches about $250 billion 3 to 4 years out, much higher in places like Asia, where the idea of having a companion dog is really just kind of coming into the mainstream. Technology, very important element here, not just in terms of how we consume pet products, including food, auto pay, auto ship on Chewy and Amazon, but also in new ways that we interact. Electronic dog collars, tracking devices, using your phone to measure how many steps your dog is taking around, monitor their heart rate, monitor medication. So lots of cool technology that we can talk about. Maybe I'll get into a couple companies, and I know that we want to have questions. So I'll run down some of the names that we own in the portfolio. Happy to talk about them in more detail. Our largest position today, which is about 9% of the fund, is a terrific small cap called Pet IQ. The symbol is PETQ. They started out in business as a reseller of flea medications. The owners are entrepreneurs, really smart, dynamic individuals out of the Midwest who were selling into Costco, have grown their portfolio of products now to several hundred, are now manufacturing products. But most interesting to me, and the reason why we think that Pet IQ is going to be a great compounder in the next 3 to 5 years, is they've gotten into the retail business. They made an acquisition a couple of years ago and are now growing a retail footprint in stores like Walmart. That's their biggest partner at the moment, where they provide easy, quick, affordable, basic veterinary services. Less than half of our pet population sees a vet in an average year. And what Pet IQ has figured out is that if you're going to the store, you're going to Walmart to buy basic products for yourself, you can take your dog with you, drop her off at the front, pick her up in half an hour. For $100, you get an annual visit, and that's important. So we think that Pet IQ is attractive. It trades at just 12 or 13 times this year's EBITDA. EBITDA should be growing in the 15-20% range. And they've done very accretive deals in the last couple of years. Our second, third, and fourth positions are all kind of interchangeable by the day. They include Chewy, which is obviously the a very large and successful online retailer, pure play in the pet market. It's getting into new areas like medications, Elanco Health, and Covetrus, which was spun off of Henry Schein a couple of years ago and is focused on the vet practices. Also, by doing software and technology, they have a platform called Vets First Choice, which is just terrific and in the very early innings of allowing pet owners to talk with the vets and ensure better compliance for kind of health regimes. Small cap name, I'll throw it out there before I stop talking. It's kind of our fifth biggest position, is one called Kindred Biosciences. The symbol is KIN. It's really a micro cap that has figured out how to take the process for getting human drugs through the FDA and apply it to the pet market at a pace that's really 1/100th the amount of time. And so they've got various applications that are coming to market or already in market for things like atopic dermatitis, a skin condition that's very common in pets. We think this stock is very attractively valued. It's probably one of the last remaining public pure play small caps we think is ripe for consolidation. The stock today is trading at $4.90. It's probably worth 10 to 15. And Graham, I think with that, I'll just stop talking and open it up for questions if that's okay.
Definitely. And for those of you out in the audience, do please let us know if you have pets hanging out at home, what you have, who your apparent potentially best friends are, if they are your best friend there. As far as questions go, we do have a question lined up from Jackie, who came in here even before we started to pose this question. And that would be, what are the most under-recognized important elements of value investing? So, for example, we all know, you know, basic things to look for, e.g., you know, low PE, manageable leverage, things like that. But what are some of the important elements that usually go unaddressed or unresearched by my novice investors?
Well, thanks for the question, Jackie. Thanks for listening. I think I'll touch on two elements. One I discussed already, which is the idea that we should gain some insight into how management is thinking about allocating capital. I mean, value isn't just on paper. It's not just looking at a model. It's not just looking at a PE ratio or an EBITDA multiple and thinking about stock being cheap. Value is also in buying a business below what you think it's worth. And so the idea of what it's worth should be based on some future assumption of how that business will evolve over time. In some of my small cap portfolios, for example, a year ago, I began aggressively buying Shake Shack. And that's a business that nobody would think of as being a value stock. Certainly wasn't cheap on most valuation metrics. But I understood how management was adapting to COVID by introducing new technology for delivery services, for pickup windows, new menu items, engaging with customers on social media, and considering how they were going to open new locations in a way that would fit kind of the new normal. And so, you know, you were buying that stock, and I think that's often missed in when most people talk about value investing, they think about stock trading at 2x book. That works too. But I think the element of understanding how management, whether you have a direct opportunity to speak or you're listening to conference calls, reading transcripts, listening to webinars, understanding how a management team is thinking about allocating capital. It doesn't mean they have to have a growth plan. It could be a company that is going to refinance their debt in a way that's creative, or thinking about slimming down by selling off non-core assets. They might communicate that. I'll talk about one briefly that I've owned for a couple of years, and that's GoGo, which was the in-flight entertainment provider that you know from all those terrible experiences on American Airlines. But what investors might have missed as a value investor is thinking about their dominant, almost monopoly-like hold on the business jet market. Stock got down to $2. Management indicated, look, we're thinking about separating the business. And lo and behold, they were able to sell the money-losing commercial aviation business. Price doesn't matter, because then what you had left was a pure play, $100 million recurring EBITDA business focused on the business aviation business jet market that's growing, and they had a clean balance sheet. And so that stock is up fivefold in the last 2 years, something like that.
Definitely. And continuing on to our next one here, coming from Jason here out in the audience, are there particular features that you look for now in companies that you invest in as opposed to those that you might have seen in earlier years? Obviously, as everything's been in kind of a crazy transition right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we've changed much about how we invest. I mean, I suppose maybe there's a greater appreciation for technology and how you think about some of those things. But that's always really been what we've done. I mean, as a firm anyway, Mario was one of the early investors in the cable companies. And, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, I mean, cable companies were technology stocks, but you understood the cash flow. And some people thought they were expensive, but some thought they were cheap. Those that didn't understand the merits of valuing the business on cash flow versus earnings, taxable earnings, I think missed out on that opportunity to own cable companies for a very long period of time. You know, owning pet companies, for example, as we do, some of them look awfully expensive. I mean, Chewy, on most traditional value metrics, might seem expensive until you think about the growth in the pet population and the fact that they are changing, dramatically changing the way consumers are able to take care of their pets, which have become more and more important parts of their lives. And so to me, it looks cheap when I think about what they can do over the next 3 to 5 years.
Absolutely. And a great question here from Praveen out in the audience here. How do you go about sourcing your ideas? Is there a specific process for finding these investments?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned that we have about 35 research analysts whose job it is to scour the planet for new ideas. By covering one industry, we found that they become experts. And so they understand who the competitors are. They understand who's doing innovative things to be more competitive. And then when, especially now, because of what's going on in SPACs, when there are new public investment opportunities, for example, in the pet industry, I'm guessing if you have a pet, you've heard of BarkBox, one of those monthly boxes that you can subscribe for a certain amount and they send you a new treat and toy, they're coming public through a SPAC. I think that's a really interesting new idea that we've started to nibble on here, because the SPACs have all kind of pulled back. But yeah, I mean, there is always, you know, by just understanding companies and reading lots of press releases, and I haven't attended conferences in some time, but virtually, there's a lot of, you know, interesting information out there. So if you're passionate about investing, which I'm guessing that you are, if you're listening to this webcast, there's always something to read and learn.
Definitely. And looks like another one here from Praveen real quick. Is there an ETF or a CEF version of the fund available at this point in time?
No, it's just an open-end mutual fund format. Like I said, the symbol is PETZX. The benefit versus an ETF is that ours is actively managed. We can take big positions in micro caps like Kindred that I mentioned versus what an ETF can do or not do. No closed-end fund at the moment, but you know, we would think about doing one or the other.
Absolutely. And another question from Jim out here in the audience. Do you have a perspective on PETS or PetMed Express? He says there's a PE of 23.6% dividends, has fallen and regained some ground over the last year. He wants to know, would you own it for your own funds, or do you see any value there?
Yeah, I mean, it has had quite a nice run. We own a small position, and kind of think about it. But in terms of their competitive positioning, it's not one of our favorite ideas at the moment in the pet fund.
Absolutely.
I should mention too that we own more than just pure plays in the portfolio. I mean, I own Amazon, for example, in the pet parents fund because they're a tremendous retailer of pet products. We own some of the consumer companies that are also in pet food, like Mills that bought Blue Buffalo. We own Colgate. We own Smucker's. We own Nestle because they're in the pet business in a big way, even though it's a small piece of their business.
For sure. And another question here from Christopher. Thanking you right up front for taking the time to come and hang out with us today, and asking on for any comments on some of the recent changes in the Focus Growth and Income Fund that you manage. Besides the enhanced yield, are you maintaining some of the old names there?
Sure. The symbol on that fund is GWSIX, if you want to follow along at home. We converted what was an actively managed value with a catalyst, event-driven, focused portfolio into an income product January of this year. Concentrated 35 names, global also, managing towards a kind of 5% current return, which we think is very attractive in the current rate environment. Talking to clients, there is an increased appetite for yield, and doing research kind of backing into it, thinking about where dividend paying stocks have gone or not gone really the past couple of years. We think there's really a catch up trade there. So we own commons, we own preferreds, we own some MLPs, some REITs, even some baby bonds in this portfolio, and we have a monthly distribution of income if that's important to an investor. Still own some of the legacy names that we think have material upside, but also are now focused on kind of dividend and income paying securities that also kind of have 20-30% appreciation potential.
Definitely. And question here from Jerry. How does macro data influence your investing, and how do you go about position sizing within these portfolios?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the macro data. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about the macro, even though, you know, it does impact our earnings estimates and the models that all of our analysts maintain and build to help us think about value. Some more than others, if they're going to be sensitive to commodity prices, for example, or interest rates, if it's a bank stock. But we spend a lot more time thinking about the micro and whether or not the current market, public market price, as we discussed, presents an attractive opportunity relative to what we believe it's worth. And that's our own kind of analysis and process for doing that. So that's the first part of the question. The second part, I think, was about sizing positions, and really it depends on the portfolio and the client. I prefer to manage much more concentrated portfolios. Some clients have a preference for otherwise. I manage a small cap strategy for one firm that kind of has us in the 50 to 60 positions range, and so sizing would be a bit different there. But you know, in theory, if we find an investment that we like a lot, in the case of the pet fund, Pet IQ, It was mispriced. It was trading down the $20 range for most of last year, kind of hovering in the low to mid 30s. Most of the start of this year, it wasn't really until 2 weeks ago when the Barron's article came out, highlighted the disconnect between public and private market prices, that the shares started to react on the upside. And so, you know, having a 9% position when others might have been much more expensive, I think was the right decision for managing the portfolio, and it's kind of paid off so far. I think the fund was up last year 55% or so, and it's up again another 10-11% this year, in part because we have half the portfolio in our top 6-7 positions.
Absolutely. And a question from 180 Project here. As you mentioned, the pandemic has impacted the numbers significantly in terms of pet ownership. What is your outlook on the industry post-pandemic?
Well, I think this is one of the changes that's here to stay for some time. The record number of fostering, meaning that you're taking a dog into your home for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, or adoptions, meaning hopefully meaning permanently, taking a dog or a cat into your home, have obviously increased dramatically during COVID in the past 13 or 14 months, in part because people were home, they want something to do, sounds cool. They're looking at Instagram and Facebook, they see all these cool dog pictures and cat pictures. And I think both from experience and from investing in the industry and understanding kind of where the trends are going, there's real merit. And my friends that have adopted in the last year or so all believe that the change in their lives from taking a pet into their home, the companionship that a pet provides is real, and it's here to stay. So I would expect that the growth in the industry, which clearly accelerated in the last year, perhaps won't be at the same rate of growth, but will continue, especially outside the U.S., as kind of the idea and the market matures elsewhere.
Definitely. And a question from WK here, one of our usual members out there in the audience. He says, Kindred has been negative EPS, negative free cash flow for 8 years now, and has also seen negative ROE and ROIC. In those types of businesses, what is the best way that our audience members should go about valuing these businesses when those traditional numbers seem a little bit untraditional?
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy, but you have to model out the potential cash flow that their pipeline can generate. So you have to go one at a time, starting with atopic dermatitis, for example, what the market is, what their investment in a specific drug might generate when it's approved, and they're on the cusp of getting, I think, several new approvals, which would meaningfully impact their cash flow in 2022 and 2023. But then also think about the value of the pipeline in its entirety and what that would be worth to a potential buyer of that business. So once you prove out, once you get approvals, I mean, they already have several joint ventures with some of the bigger public companies in the pet market. But once you prove out additional applications, I think that there is, you know, a fair amount of a potential for this company to be consolidated in some fashion. And so you put a multiple on what the revenues might be next year or the year after, and that you can discount that back however you choose to do it. And that's how you get to a price that, you know, warrants a 6% position in a pet fund, for example.
Absolutely. And it looks like another great question here from Praveen. What is your criteria for selling? How do you decide if something is overvalued? So, for example, here he's posed IDEX, one of your large positions, has really run up. How would you evaluate it?
Yeah, I mean, IDEX is a terrific business, but you're absolutely right. It's run up. We we've trimmed it, only to be proven wrong every time we've done that, of course, because they continue to just kind of innovate and grow and explore new product categories. I think that diagnostics is a really important component to how we're going to care for our pets in the future. And clearly they're a leader. It's hard to think about sizing the other question versus just outright selling. So, you know, we've trimmed IDEX a little bit, but also when you have inflows in a fund, it kind of naturally becomes a smaller position. We're tax sensitive in terms of selling stocks, unless we think there's something fundamentally wrong that we didn't appreciate when we first bought the stock. So that also kind of goes into our picture.
Definitely. And just to, I guess, kind of continue on that with a very long-term focus, obviously, and a lot of these companies have been around in these funds and portfolios for a while now. What are we looking as far as turnover of these stocks kind of coming in and out?
Yeah, I mean, all of the strategies I manage are very low turnover, and the same would go for Mario and most of my colleagues, in part because we don't buy stock with the idea that they're going to beat the quarter, right? We buy it after doing a lot of fundamental analysis with the idea that we want to own this business for 3 to 5+ years. And if we're right, we can own it much longer because the business and the management team that we are betting on have proven us correct in our assessment that they're adept at investing for the future, whether that means growth in revenues or the future of their business by kind of focusing on new areas, and they're doing what's right for public shareholders.
Absolutely.
So happy to own stocks for a very long time.
For sure.
Or forever.
And you mentioned SPACs earlier. Any thoughts there with any of the potential regulations coming out here in the future, or if these are truly going to be value plays moving into the future?
I don't have a ton of thoughts on potential regulation, nor really value. I suppose, I mean, there are now, only in the last couple of days or 2 weeks or so, I think, a couple of SPACs trading below the IPO or cash value. So I guess by classic definition, that would be a value stock. You can make a couple of pennies, and you have free optionality on the company doing a good deal. Not that I'm an expert on SPACs. Otherwise, I mean, it's really, you know, betting on the jockey. I mean, for example, Liberty Media, John Malone, and Greg Maffei have launched a SPAC. It's trading above cash, but 20%, 30% below where it was trading at the IPO. And that's probably pretty interesting because their ability to do a deal, one would think, is better than really anyone else at the moment. They just have great access to deal flow and also creative financing. You know, SPACs are really interesting. I mentioned that I nibbled on the one that is going to merge with BarkBox and the pet fund. That's the only one I really own at the moment. I think there's probably going to be some opportunities
for sure.
For the space.
Definitely. And you also mentioned earlier Amazon obviously becoming a key player, and there's news coming out or headlines, I guess, in the last few days, putting them as taking over as far as retailing goes. Do you see that companies are transitioning more to that kind of online retailer model moving into the future, or even potentially going more towards that direct-to-consumer type model?
Yeah, I don't see how you can avoid adapting a business to offer customer preferences for online shopping. Everything from groceries, fresh groceries, to, of course, clothing and pet food is now available to be delivered to your front door same day. I don't know, in a retail environment, how you can really stay competitive if you aren't investing in technology in some fashion.
Absolutely. And another question from Jim out here in the audience. Do you see any seasonality in the pet business?
Not really. I mean, I think, yeah, there are certain periods where you have flea and tick or other other types of medical conditions that might cause increased trips to the veterinarian. But otherwise, it's a terrific business. One of the reasons why we've invested in it for a long time, one of the reasons why the multiples are so healthy, that's because it's a consistent grower. And we think that there are a number of opportunities to make it a much more dynamic and interesting investable area, including technology, including growth of the population.
Definitely. And we'll give the audience here a few more moments, and I'll pose one more at you here. You'd have mentioned it being a global investment strategy, China specifically seeing some potential growth here in the future. Are there any other international regions that you believe are going to be kind of key players for the fund moving into the future?
I mean, there's not one specific region that I think is key to the growth of the pet market, but I would just say that the U.S. Is the leader. The U.S. is probably, I forget if I gave the numbers earlier, but the U.S. is probably half, call it $100 billion of the $200 billion pet economy. And so clearly the U.S. is not half of the world in terms of population, human population. So I think that there's a lot more potential for societies to catch up to the benefits and understand the benefits of having a companion pet. And when that happens, there's probably great opportunities for some of the international names, the global producers that we're invested in, or even just some of the kind of, you know, European centric firms. One of the best performers, if not the best performer in the portfolio last year, was a company called Pets at Home, which is based in London. I visited with the management team 2 or 3 times when I was over there a couple of years ago. You know, they have a terrific hybrid retail care model, similar to kind of what Pet IQ is doing now in the U.S. And they've won. I mean, they, you know, maybe a small sell-off at the start of COVID, but then it's been a great place to be invested, and I think it will be for some time.
Absolutely. And looks like we have another few questions rolling in here. One from WK asking specifically regarding China. I guess what are your sources of information there, if you can reveal them, or any thoughts on looking to Alibaba there?
We don't have any special sources other than a couple of analysts that are based in Hong Kong and Tokyo, and one in Shanghai. Publicly available information. We don't have a ton of capital allocated in Asia at the moment. I don't have a view on Alibaba.
Definitely. So boots on the ground strategy there.
Yeah.
And it looks like we have a question from Kathy here in the audience. We did hit on it already, but just asking if you have a view into the pet economy opportunity in China and any exposure there, if you want to briefly hit on that again.
Yeah, again, it's not a big exposure. I'd like it to be. We're looking for ways to make it a bigger part of our portfolio, because I do think the growth rate will be way above average the next 3 to 5 years. We don't have a name or two that I would share with you that would be kind of pure play exposures. I mean, I think some of the big multinationals, the Zoetis's, for example, which is a top position for us, will benefit from that market.
Absolutely. And question here from Blaine out in the audience, and he says that he sees a lot of companies with negative shareholder equities from share repurchases. Is that a negative factor in your analysis?
negative equity from repurchases. No, that's not something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. In the pet world, not a lot of the companies are buying back their own stock, in part because they're investing in new growth in other industries where we've been invested, and are involved in companies that are active buyers of their own shares. I haven't really seen a negative return, at least not in the last couple of years.
Definitely. Well, that is going to round out our questions here today from the audience. Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us today and taking the time to answer all these questions for our audience. Like I said, it's been a pleasure.
Good questions. I appreciate them.
Absolutely. And for those out in the audience, we thank you for joining us as well, and we wish everybody well moving into the future. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.